Welcome to Byline. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, this week in Frankfort, Governor Steve Beshear delivered his sixth State of the Commonwealth address as lawmakers resumed their short legislative session. This is a 30-day session. Repairing the worst of the damage from the recession, fixing Kentucky's failing public pension system, and overhauling the tax code are among the top, or at the top of the governor's legislative agenda. And here to talk about what will be and what may not be considered this session is Kentucky Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief Kenny Colston, who joins us from Frankfort. Hey, Kenny.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm pretty well.
Well, the governor's speech, conspicuous by its absence, was any mention of expanded gambling in Kentucky, which, of course, has been one of the governor's top priorities in years past. Why didn't he bring it up this time?
Well, I think that just shows that he doesn't have the support behind the proposal that he's pushing now. He knows that a proposal that gives the horse racing tracks a monopoly, so to speak, which they call giving protections, that won't pass the state Senate. And so now he's working on a clean amendment. Unfortunately, the clean amendment that doesn't give any protections to the horse racing industry can't get all the support of the horse racing tracks. So basically with that, you know, not having an agreement there and having so many other things to talk about and to deal with, I think the governor just made a play to take it off the table for this session. By no means do I think he's done with the expanded gambling issue, but with tax reform and pensions on the table, I think he just decided to clear the table a little bit, and that's why we didn't hear it mentioned.
Well, there's been a flurry of activity, as you well know, since the General Assembly resumed this week. Let's talk about pensions, first of all. A bill has passed the Senate, correct?
That is correct. It passed yesterday.
And is this something that could clear the House as well, or that our lawmakers would find it palatable?
Well, here's the deal with the pension reform bill. It's basically right now, it's the pure recommendations of the task force that took up public pensions. And that means a suspension of cost of living adjustments, a new hybrid 401k style plan for new hires, a few other technical things on double dipping and stuff like that. But the House is pretty adamant that there needs to be a funding source for those recommendations. Currently, the bill, as it came out of the Senate, does not say how you pay for that. Chief among those, how you pay for what they call the ARC, A-R-C, the Actuarial Required Contribution. And so the House wants to find a way to pay for that. House Speaker Greg Stumbo said today that they've come up with a few ideas, but he wasn't going to tell the media quite what they were yet. So the chances of this bill getting tweaked in the House, it's probably likely. You know, whether that actually comes to the floor tweaked or whether they play around with some floor amendments or committee substitute, all these technical ways to change a bill, will be up to House lawmakers. But the House is adamant that the funding needs to be there to pass anything. And depending on what they do with the funding, the Senate could have problems. You know, we've been talking a lot about Kumbaya and the bipartisanship in Frankfort this week. And as soon as the House changes that pension bill, we'll really get to see how well everyone's going to get along with each other across the aisle, or whether these philosophical differences between the two chambers, the House and the Senate, will start to boil again.
But a lot of talk about tax reform. There was a Blue Ribbon panel that chaired by former Mayor Jerry Abramson, who's now the Lieutenant Governor, and it has come up with some recommendations, but it doesn't appear likely anything's going to happen in the session regarding that.
No, and oddly enough, there's quite a few lawmakers who are chomping at the bit for a bill on tax reform, but Lieutenant Governor Jerry Abramson has said that, you know, they're unlikely to produce a bill or, you know, get a lawmaker to produce a bill that, you know, is basically backed by the governor, that are the Blue Ribbon Tax Reform Commission's recommendation. The governor seems to be wanting to talk with House Speaker Greg Stumbo, talk with Senate President Robert Stivers, and come to conclusions on a bill before one is introduced. He seems to want to get that support on the front end rather than putting a bill out and really getting it on, I guess, what you would call the back end of the conversation. Of course, State Representative Jim Wayne basically took a large part of the commission's proposals and put them into his own bill, tweaked them a little bit, and so that's on the table. But basically, the governor wants lawmakers to sit down, take the recommendations as a starting point, and craft their own bill. He doesn't seem to be just taking the recommendations completely as is. And while that's probably unlikely that a bill, compromise on tax reform happens this legislative session, the governor pushed in his State of the Commonwealth speech that something has to be agreed on by the end of the year, in his opinion.
Speaking of the State of the Commonwealth speech, we have a soundbite from that. Let's listen to it.
Simply put, we realize that just getting by is no longer.
Well, the governor sounds a little muffled there. We'll try to get back to it in a moment. But the gist of the cut we were going to play, Kenny, is that he's saying this is kind of a new day. We're emerging from the recession. There's new leadership. I don't know if he mentioned David Williams by name being gone, but this is kind of a transition era in Frankfort.
Exactly. The whole point of the governor's speech was, is we've heard him for, I don't know, me and you, Rick, probably a few years now talking about how many times he's balanced the budget, but he's protected education. And this year's State of the Commonwealth was basically a pivot from that. It was basically saying, yes, we cut the budget, and we were happy that we cut the budget in tough times, and we survived the recession, so to speak. But, you know, it was too deep in some areas, especially in education. And he was basically trying to tell lawmakers and the general public that the error of cutting services, cutting education or any services is over in his mind, that he wants tax reform to do new revenue, that he wants to start building the state back up. And like you said in the speech, you know, they have to look 5, 10, even 25 years down the road now. They can't just look at the next budget to figure out how they're going to plug holes. And he used that argument to make the case for tax reform, that, you know, they have to have more revenue. The tax code has to be more flexible for lawmakers to plug budgets, and not only to plug budgets, but to help fund textbooks again, after-school services, to really pour into education and other social services that the governor deems important.
Other issues coming up this week, a smoking bill has emerged from one of the chambers, right? Or from committee.
That's right. The House House Committee has already passed a statewide smoking ban bill. That got an endorsement from the governor in his State of the Commonwealth speech. It's probably going to sail through the House fairly easily. House Speaker Greg Stumbo says that he doesn't expect it to have much, if any, trouble at all. But it will have trouble in the Senate. Both Senate President Robert Stivers and new Majority Floor Leader Damon Thayer say that they don't believe it's government's role to tell a bar or a pool hall or a restaurant whether or not they can allow smoking in their building. They don't think that's government's role. Obviously, that's not what the speaker and the bill sponsor think, so they're going to have to woo GOP members of the Senate to try to get this bill passed if they want it to become law.
And another issue that I think the governor brought up in his speech that he's been close to his heart and the First Lady's heart as well has been the raising the dropout age. Is there any chance that's going to win passage this time around?
Well, it'll have easy going again in the House. They'll probably take that bill up here pretty soon. And there's a new education committee chairman in the Senate. And he told CN2 this week that there is some room for compromise on that bill. We heard the governor say in his State of the Commonwealth address that almost every school district has some sort of alternative or technical education aspect in their county system now. And that was the holdup beforehand. The people were, Republicans in the Senate were basically saying, you know, you're going to keep these kids in school, but you're not going to, all they're going to do is disrupt. The ones who want to drop off, all they're going to do is disrupt other students who really want to learn. You need to have some sort of alternative or career aspect to get these kids who want to drop out and keep them interested so that they actually graduate. And so now the governor says that that's actually available in almost every county and every school district in the state. There seems to be some room for compromise. What that final compromise will be is yet to be unseen, but the new Senate Education Committee had lost 3 or 4 of its members who were against the bill. We have talked about how it's a new day. I think it's got a shot. It just depends on what the governor and House members may be willing to compromise on.
I'm talking with Kentucky Public Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Kenny Colston from Frankfort. I want to switch gears here and talk about something else. The Super PAC American Crossroads released a stinging ad targeting actress and activist Ashley Judd this week. She, of course, is considering a bid against Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. And the Digital Spot portrays Judd as an out-of-touch Hollywood liberal, criticizes her for being a supporter of President Obama, living in Tennessee, etc. Let's listen to the ad.
You know what this country really needs? An independent voice for Obama.
I am committed to President Obama and Vice President Biden. I think he's a brilliant man. He is now able to flower more as the president I knew he could be.
A leader who knows how to follow.
I will go wherever the president wants me to go.
Someone who will never forget where she came from.
And it just clicked. Tennessee is home. And it just clicked.
Kentucky
is home.
Someone who knows what's good for us.
Obamacare has done so much for us right here in Tennessee.
Someone who shares our values.
I got radical. I've been progressively and delightfully radical.
Someone from out of state who understands us hillbillies.
I don't know a lot of hillbillies who golf. Hillbillies, hillbillies, hillbillies.
Her own grandmother says she's a Hollywood liberal. But isn't that what we need? Ashley Judd. An Obama-following radical Hollywood liberal who's right at home here in Tennessee. Kentucky.
And it just clicked. Tennessee is home.
Okay. Well, that's a little rough, isn't it?
Brutal.
Joining us to talk about it here, along with Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston, is WFPL political editor Philip M. Bailey. Philip, welcome to the program.
Hey, Rick.
Well, who's behind the American Crossroads Super PAC?
Well, Karl Rove, known to many as Bush's brain, who was a special assistant to President George W. Bush. He's the founder of American Crossroads, which is known around these parts and political parts as one of the more active super PACs. This ad is pretty brutal. I mean, it hits Ashley Judd on pretty much every negative she has. She's from Hollywood. She lives in Tennessee, not Kentucky. She's been a proud supporter of President Obama. I think this ad in many ways sort of softens her up for any sort of bid she's thinking about doing. Many consider her to be running already. It's just a matter of, will she announce? She's taking every tiptoe step towards that. Also, it's important to note that McConnell does have a connection to American Crossroads, even though his campaign had nothing to do with this ad. Stephen J. Law is the president of American Crossroads. He was a former campaign manager for Mitch McConnell back in 1990 and later served as his chief of staff. So McConnell does have some fingerprints on this ad, if not directly.
Now, she responded to this in any way?
Yes, actually through her publicist, which is sort of interesting that, you know, she's not running, but yet she has a publicist who is ready to respond to these sort of ads. And she said that, quote, Ashley thanks Senator McConnell, Karl Rove, and their negative allies for all the attention as she considers her future political plans, although a decision hasn't been made yet. And the reason I think that statement is very telling is that she immediately connects Rove to McConnell. And Karl Rove has had his own problems with the Tea Party that could, you know, as we all know here, Senator McConnell has had problems with the Tea Party, but Rove has had problems with the Tea Party as well, in that they think that he is someone who's trying to keep Tea Party candidates from running in Republican primaries.
Kenny Colston in Frankfort, has there been any response to the possibility of Ashley Judd running for this seat? I know there are some potential candidates in your neck of the woods.
Well, yeah, I mean, Judd obviously is a candidate on the tip of everyone's tongue, but she doesn't necessarily have great support from, I guess, all Democrats. I mean, I've spoken with Auditor Adam Edelin before, and he's more of the mindset that he would like to see Secretary of State Allison Lundergan Grimes run rather than Judd. House Speaker Greg Stumbo is not really supportive of Ashley Judd either. But then again, you know, some lawmakers are, you know, it really just depends on their personal preference. I think at the end of the day, what Democratic lawmakers around here want is someone who can actually beat Mitch McConnell. And those who don't support Ashley Judd are basically buying the mindset that she cannot beat him in the general election.
Has she said if she's set a timeline as to when she might run?
She has not. I mean, she tweeted out yesterday asking people to sign up for her mailing list, sort of giving a wink saying, you know, I might announce anything. Who knows? Wink, wink. And I think as Kenny mentioned, you know, a lot of attention and coverage has been put on Senator McConnell and his divide and problems with the Tea Party. I think that's a justifiable story that you've seen WFPL cover a lot lately. But also, as Kenny's reporting has shown, the Kentucky Democratic Party hasn't gotten its act together either. There is a serious discussion and debate going on. And you see it sometimes on MSNBC and other places with former Lieutenant Governor Dan Mangiardo coming out pretty much smacking down the idea of a Judd candidacy. The divide between Democrats is, do we run someone who's very liberal, who can sort of get the national attention that Judd would bring, Or do we get someone who is more maybe moderate or not as well known, but who would certainly have a better maybe ground game in Kentucky? The Kentucky Democratic Party has not been able to get a viable candidate to defeat Mitch McConnell in 30 years. His 2014 election, he'll be in office for 30 years at that time. And Democrats have been the ones who have failed to get a really unifying candidate, even though they outnumber Republicans in this state.
Now, before we let you go here, we've got just a few seconds left, Philip. Speaking of attack ads, Senator McConnell was the subject of one regarding his position on gun control.
Yes, this liberal advocacy group, PCCC, came out with an ad showing a gun owner here in Kentucky basically calling out Senator McConnell for his opposition to gun control measures that have been supported by the president, namely the background checks, universal background checks, and the ban on assault weapons. That ad has been running on cable. That group announced today, in fact, that they're expanding their ad buy. They have more money as a result of that ad running. And you'll see that ad during the UofL Notre Dame game this weekend. You also see it on the Sunday talk shows, Sunday political talk shows, and before, during, and after the president's State of the Union address. So this group is certainly hitting McConnell here at his home state. The McConnell campaign has responded by saying, look, this group is pretty far to the left. It was very critical of President Obama himself. It's been funded by a liberal billionaire George Soros. They're out of touch with Kentucky voters. I haven't yet heard if this ad is having any traction as far as getting pressure on McConnell to change his position on the Second Amendment. But it certainly shows you that already, I mean, we're in February 2013. The election isn't until November 2014, and we already have groups spending ads against McConnell.
All right. Our thanks to Kenny Colston for joining us from Frankfort. Philip Bailey is going to stick around for our next segment, and we'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, there were some developments this week in the ethics case against Louisville Metro Councilwoman Barbara Shanklin, who's accused of using her elected office to benefit herself and some family members. And here to talk about it are WFPL's Philip Bailey and Devin Katayama. Welcome in, Devin.
Thank you.
Well, the Ethics Commission this week received some recommendations from the hearing officer assigned to the case, Devin.
Yeah, Ann Shadell did turn in her recommendations, and this is based on the findings of fact in the ethics hearing that they held last year. And this hearing was basically Councilwoman Barbara Shanklin is accused of violating five provisions of the city's ethics code. And they held the hearing last year. She twice walked out of the hearing at the her attorney told her to, basically. So both sides were supposed to address that issue specifically in their recommendations to Ann Shadell, again, the hearing officer who acts like judge in the case. And then Ann Shadell basically looks at the whole transcript of the hearing, and she makes her recommendations to the commission, which were accepted this week.
So when can we expect something to happen?
They're saying about March 15th is when they're actually going to be releasing the information. And we won't be able to see exactly what Shadell recommended until that time. They did say everything would be made public at that time. But earlier this week when all the media was at the hearing or at the acceptance or at the commission, they had the big old stack of papers, thousands of pages that they didn't let us see. But that's basically what they're going to be going through. And the commission did meet in an executive session this week, and so we weren't able to hear what they were thinking. But they did come out and set up three scheduled deliberations or meetings that they're going to have over the next several weeks to kind of talk about this.
And Philip, just to review, what is it exactly that Councilwoman Shanklin is accused of doing wrong?
Well, yeah, the five different counts, I mean, they center on different issues. I think the one that caught the most attention was the issue of the upholstery program, a program that Metro Corrections had run that Councilwoman Shanklin had sponsored that was for ex-offenders. A review that was in the Courier-Journal, the story that broke this initially, was that you saw in the transcripts, or at least in the sign-in sheets, very few ex-offenders were actually in the program and referred, but you did see Councilwoman Shanklin and many of her family members who are participating in the program. I believe, Devin, some of the other charges involve the issue of her grandson working. Was he paid when he was incarcerated? He was her legislative aide at the time. Right. And other issues of her using sort of city taxpayer dollars to benefit herself. She faces five different counts. So you could see a situation where on one count she may not necessarily get a censure or a fine. They recommend removal for others. You could see the situation where the commission recommends no removal whatsoever or no public censure and just a fine. There are many different variables at play here. But I know that Councilman Shanklin, who's been pretty much under the radar since this ethics trial has started, is waiting and hopefully wants this thing to get over as quickly as possible.
So this panel makes recommendations to the council, and then the council actually takes the action, if there is any action.
If there's a recommendation for removal. Now, the commission on its own can issue a fine or issue a letter of public censure. But if it recommends removal, we would see the process that we saw 2 years ago involving the late Councilman Judy Green, where the council would then have to have first five individuals would have to sign a petition of removal. Then you would see the council turn into a courtroom where it would have its own trial to decide whether to remove Councilwoman Shanklin or not.
I see. And so this could happen in mid-March or so. And meantime, she filed a lawsuit against the mayor over records.
Yeah. The interesting thing is while this is going on and Devin's dealing with the ethics component of this, Councilwoman Shanklin's attorney, Aubrey Williams, they filed a lawsuit specifically against Mayor Fisher and his office, saying that the mayor's office denied records involving the upholstery program, like I said, which was one of the counts that she faces in the ethics hearing, basically saying that the mayor denied her seeing certain records on what authority he had to shut down the program. As many might remember, it was the mayor's office that stepped in and said, oh, we see some issues with this program. I think Metro Corrections Director Mark Bolton, he ultimately was the one who terminated the contract. Williams argued that, listen, we want to see those records and the mayor's office is denying us the right to see them. At the court, the judge basically dismissed that lawsuit, saying that her not seeing those records does not impact the case at all. It does not injure her as far as that case is concerned, that the mayor's office tried to fulfill that records request as best as possible, but that you're asking them to do research for you. Even though both sides seem to agree, both the city and Aubrey Williams seem to agree that the attorney general's opinion in their initial appeal was mixed. It was really confusing that it sided with both of them. Aubrey Williams made the accusation that the attorney general's office was being political, and that's why that decision was split.
All right, WFPL's Philip M. Bailey talking about the Barbara Shanklin case. Philip, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Devin's going to stick around for a moment because we're going to switch gears here and talk about the Big Four Bridge. It's now open to pedestrians and bicyclists. The Louisville approach to the former railroad bridge was opened yesterday. The Indiana ramp is still under construction, but is expected to be completed in late spring. Devin was on hand for the long-awaited opening of the repurposed bridge yesterday, and here are some of the sounds he gathered.
Mayor, can you describe what you're seeing right now?
Total excitement here. You can see people are getting ready to come across the bridge for the first time. The train whistle's blowing. Look how happy everybody is right now.
Lieutenant Governor, can you describe what you're seeing right now?
Well, the energy and excitement is just unbelievable. We've been waiting so long. This is a tremendous opportunity for our community, a dream come true.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
All right.
Devin, nice day yesterday for getting up on the bridge. Looks like a lot of excitement. Sounds like it as well.
There's a lot of people there, more than I expected, and I think more than anybody there expected. Mayor Fisher was on hand. Lieutenant Governor Jerry Abramson, you heard his voice in there. David Karam, the president of the Louisville Waterfront Development Corporation, he was there as well as Jeffersonville Mayor Mike Moore. So a large collaboration. Obviously, both sides needed a hand in this. And again, this is the soft opening of the Big Four Bridge, so the Jeffersonville side is still being worked on at this time.
Then that was my next question. I haven't been over there yet. So you walk up the ramp to the bridge, and how far across can you go?
You can go across almost the whole bridge. At the end, you're going to be stopped by a barrier. And again, that's just because they're developing that. It should be done, they're saying, by summer. This week, it was quite the scene. You know, there was tons of people, tons of different types of people too. A lot of people coming out to jog, run, some families and pets. Met one gentleman, Brad Hammond, who was telling stories while on top of the bridge.
That's beautiful, ain't it? And we've been waiting about 25 years for this. It means a lot to me, like it does everybody, but in 1960, the last time a train went across, my brother claims that he rode across it. Not that he was supposed to. But he died in June of this year. So to me, we're both walking across it today. His name is Shelby Hammond.
What kind of connection did your brother have to this bridge?
Well, as a kid, we used to get a kick at a jumping the freight trains, which we weren't supposed to do, and riding across it. And we always lived along the river, and we always loved it. So.
Then a little bit further down on the bridge, I ran into Rick Bell, who actually authored Louisville's Waterfront Park, A Riverfront Renaissance. He was saying that this was a huge moment for him, and I caught him taking a picture overlooking the city.
Well, that's unbelievably cool. You can see the change in this community more graphically here than any other single spot. And I think you also see this link to that this is one big community, the Indiana Center, what used to be called the Fall Cities. It really just reemphasizes it's still the Fall Cities. We still are related. And when the other side is finished, when you can go all the way down, it's really a very, very cool experience.
What does it mean for the city to develop this area? Obviously, you wrote a book about
it. Yeah, it's been a major triumph, and it has always been the city's chief asset. For the first 150 years of our history, especially during the steamboat era, the waterfront was the most valuable property in the city, and we've always had this very special relationship to the water's edge in this community.
And obviously, this is a very historic bridge. It was built in the late 19th century and closed in the late 1960s, I believe. So it's kind of, this is the renaissance, like he was saying, of this bridge. And obvious, it was pretty obvious when you were out there that a lot of people were excited about this.
I was talking to David Karam of the Waterfront Development Corporation the other day, and he said this is an idea that first came up in 1991, something like that, turning it into a pedestrian bridge.
Right.
So it's been a long time coming. And also, before we let you go, can you go up any time? When's it open?
Yeah, it's open 24 hours a day, closed for thunder over Louisville, and it's also going to be closed during certain weather conditions, probably extreme conditions is my guess, and also be closed for certain repairs. There are a few rules, and I was reminded of this this week when I was sending out a joke tweet in a way and saying, get your rollerblades ready, but there actually will be no inline skates, roller skates or skateboards allowed. Obviously, bicycles and jogging will definitely be allowed, so there are a couple of rules.
And if you can't get over there right away, we have some great photos taken by Laura Valentine, our WFPL intern. You can see them on our website, WFPL.org. Devin Katayama, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Byline on WFPL. Yesterday, the Federal Chemical Safety Board released its review of the March 2011 explosion at Carbide Industries in Rubbertown that killed two workers and injured two more. The CSB concluded that Carbide ignored warning signs and accepted dangerous situations as standard operations. The CSB held a public meeting last night to discuss the report and to pass a set of recommended regulations that, if implemented, could prevent more accidents like this from happening. WFPL's news director Gabe Bullard has been covering the story, and we'll talk to him in a moment, but first here's a sampling of reaction to the findings yesterday.
Deaths of workers cannot simply be another cost of doing business. We have come to Louisville tonight to say no way.
Of course, I wish this meeting had been held in a location in West Louisville where more residents could have attended. That would have been much more convenient and made a whole lot of sense.
Seeing this report today and seeing that there was 26 ask work orders, whatever you want to call them, to correct some of these hazards, and those were ignored. My personal opinion is that's criminal, and it's a shame in this country today that it's not treated as criminal.
Management has the privilege of going home to places that are far from West Louisville. They don't have to wake up and try to go to sleep to the smells that are emitted from the plants in Rubbertown.
Workers and people living near the fence line can no longer be seen as expendable. The government must require these facilities to protect life and quality of life. To the best of their ability, there must be a mandated switch to safer alternatives. By not making the move to inherently safer technology, at minimum, you get releases that cause harm and nuisance to people. But at the other end of the spectrum, you get death like there was at Carbide.
And WFPL's Gabe Bullard joins us now. Gabe, quite an emotional hearing as we heard yesterday. Well, the board has determined, the investigation has determined that really the company kind of took a Band-Aid approach to this furnace.
Right. The Carbide Industries had known that there were problems with the furnace or ignored some of the warning signs. I'm not an expert exactly in electric arc furnace operation, but as the report laid out, there had been some coolant leaks. Cooling water had leaked. There had been some boil overs, as they call them, that had damaged some of the casing around this furnace. And there had been previous blowouts with the furnace that it would release some pressurized gas at high temperatures. And what the CSB really laid out is that, one, those should have been addressed, but also the control room, which was one story above the furnace, or is on the second story, and had these glass windows, that should have been moved. It was about 12 feet away from where these blasts were happening, and smaller blasts before had blown out the windows in the control room. Carbide had taken some steps to reinforce that glass. It was double paned. It was later reinforced again, but that was one thing that the CSB said should have happened, that the control room should have been moved.
Has Carbide reacted publicly to the report?
Yeah, Carbide says they've been agreeing with it, or that they have been supportive of the CSB's investigation, that they want to implement these safety procedures, and they're going to continue to work on that, but that they have addressed the what has been mentioned in the CSB report.
Now, are there any potential penalties involved here?
Well, that's not really something that the Chemical Safety Board can do exactly. They're a non-regulatory body, independent federal agency. So, in fact, they've just offered some recommendations. They were asked if there would be any sort of criminal charges filed. That's not for them to determine. That's something that would have to be set out by completely different agencies. But all the CSB can really do is research this, find out what happened, give the report on what happened, and recommend that other agencies take up some regulations that could stop this from happening.
Now, you talked to some folks yesterday, family members and friends and others involved with the incident. What's been the public reaction? Are people satisfied with the report?
Last night at the meeting, Councilwoman Attica Woodson Scott, whose district surrounds much of Rubbertown, she said that, one, she wishes the meeting would have been held in Rubbertown. There were six people who spoke publicly. It was held downtown at the Seelbach Hotel. She says had it been held in Rubbertown or closer to the scene of the accident, more people could have turned out. But she ended by saying that she's glad that the CSB was holding Carbide accountable. We heard in the last bit of sound there, that was Ebony Cochran of Rubbertown Emergency Action, who expressed that, you know, this shows that in a lot of ways there is a feeling that the industry is a bit lax about the safety of workers and the safety and health of people living around those plants. There's a feeling that these folks are marginalized living in Rubbertown and the surrounding area.
You can read and hear Gabe Bullard's reporting on the Carbide Industries investigation at WFPL.org. Gabe, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Byline on WFPL. At age 22, Louisville native Jennifer Lawrence is already a two-time nominee for an Academy Award, this time for her role in Silver Linings Playbook. As she prepares for the Oscars on February 24th, Lawrence discussed her quick rise to Hollywood stardom with WFPL's Joseph Lord.
It's interesting. You had an interesting year, obviously, because of the Hunger Games and this as well. Why do you think the films that are getting the award nominations seem to tend to be the small-budget films? There are obviously exceptions, but the big blockbusters like Hunger Games or whatnot don't seem to get as much respect.
I mean, everybody makes a movie for different reasons. Some people make movies to make people laugh or to scare them, and there's some movies that are made for entertainment, and that's probably more along the lines of what the Hunger Games falls under. But at the same time, I mean, I think that we made something that did a lot more, hopefully, than entertain people. I mean, I stand by the message of the movie, and I've never been prouder. And, you know, we loved what we were doing, but it wasn't the kind of, we weren't sending out for your consideration DVDs. We just kind of made it so that people would want to see it. And then there are certain movies that are made for this kind of thing that will never really be watched unless they go in this award circuit. I mean, they're smaller movies, you know, like Silver Linings or like Amour, Beast of a Southern Wild, and things like that.
The first time we talked, I think it was about 2009, and it was before Winter's Bone had premiered at Sundance, and I remember you saying something to the effect of that you wanted to, you were doing these sort of gritty indie movies, but you wanted to try to do everything. It hasn't been that long, but obviously you've been in a lot of movies. What haven't you done yet? I mean, do you want to do a slapstick comedy or?
I don't know. It's really, I just kind of go script by script now. There's not really, I don't really shut anything out, like, oh, well, I'm not going to do a kind of movie like that. It's really just about the script. And I've been so fortunate to be able to discover so many parts of film. I remember that was what was so appealing about X-Men, because I had only done indies before. And I was just like, I want to know what a big studio film is like, and with CG, and being a part of something that's that massive. And that was really, you know, interesting to me. And then went back to indies, because I was like, yeah, seen it. I think I like this more.
So when Winter's Bone came out, you started becoming sort of famous. But now you're obviously with the Hunger Games, you're much more famous. I remember I asked this because, or mentioned this because I think maybe you were in Louisville sometime around Christmas, because there was a I think the Courier-Journal had a story about you shopping for bedding. Is that strange to know that when you go out just Christmas shopping or what have you, that it,
wow,
it might end up in a newspaper?
I didn't know that.
How do you feel about that. All that?
I think it's gross. I mean, the same thing happens when I'm in L.A. I mean, yesterday I had 7 paparazzi following me, and they were all running red lights, and I'm afraid they're going to kill somebody. And when you try to have a conversation with somebody, and then there's people just shoving their iPhones in your face and taking pictures of you like you're a zoo animal. And I think that there's something happens when a person becomes famous where it's like all of a sudden they're just they're expected to lose their humanity. And it does a very weird, I always knew that like paparazzi and this whole thing, it would be annoying, but I didn't know that it hurts your feelings. Like, it just makes you feel like people don't actually consider you a person. You know, like I was going to buy groceries last weekend, and there's this new chain of paparazzi who just carry a video camera while they're taking pictures of you, and they video you, and they start making fun of you to try to make you mad so that they can get a reaction so that they can sell it. And I'm like what you do to monkeys in the zoo when you like bang on the glass and try to make them mad to get a reaction. It's just like, it hurts your feelings, because it's like, dude, I just want to go buy some groceries, and you're making fun of me with a camera in my face. Like, yeah, so I think it's really gross, and it makes me feel like people don't expect me to be a human anymore.
People seem to like when you're on the talk shows because you seem to have a penchant for being very candid. Why do you take that approach when you go on these shows? You seem to be willing to pretty much say anything.
I was talking to my friend about that, because I was like, I don't do it on purpose. I just have never, maybe I haven't had enough media training.
People seem to enjoy it. They seem to react to it pretty well, though.
Well, that's good. It's only a matter of time.
Do you worry about that before you go on these shows, that you're going to say something that's going to really get you in trouble with your publicist?
Oh, my God, of course. I mean, while I'm talking, I'm worried about it. But I'm just like, I feel like there's, you can't take it so seriously, like, forever. Like, it's just a job. And then yeah, I get the same anxiety where, like, I'll do a red carpet, and then at night I'm, like, laying in bed, and I just get that, like, anxiety, because I'm like, oh, God, did I say something? Did I offend somebody? Like, oh, because it's like, you know, it's like high school. Like, you want people to like you. You don't want anybody. You can't, as much as you tell yourself, like, I don't care if people like me. Yeah, screw it. Like, I can say that about some things and make myself feel better. But you want to be liked. You don't want to, you know, offend anyone or anything like that. So there is some pressure. But I found that, like, I would feel much better if I was hated just for being myself. I would be like, all right, well, I went out there and I was myself. They didn't like it, so whatever. And then if I put on some sort of masquerade or something.
That's Oscar nominee and Louisville native Jennifer Lawrence talking to WFPL's Joseph Lord. She's nominated for Silver Linings Playbook in the Best Actress category. The Oscars are February 24th. We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Howlett. Louisville's Le Petitmain Theater Ensemble creates highly original stage comedies from scratch. WFPL's Aaron Keene followed the theater troupe through the process of developing and staging its new show, No Punchbacks.
When the members of Le Petitmain head into rehearsal for a new play, they don't have a script. They don't have a director. What they have is an idea and roughly 500 years of comedic history behind them.
And when you whack me in my hunched back with a slapstick, then people don't go, oh my God, what horrible thing is happening. They're thinking of Daffy Duck. And I don't know if there's any sense of the guys, Warner Brothers, being, you know, we should recreate it. It's just that there's a certain thing that works that I think has passed down long enough that part of the vaudeville that they were stealing their gags from was the commedia that vaudeville stole its gags from.
No Punchbacks is based on Punch and Judy, the traditional British puppet show. The three actors create 8 characters, writing, directing, choreographing, and composing the original script, songs, and dance numbers. That's Christy Rollup singing the role of a coquettish French sausage. It's that kind of show. She also plays a giant-fisted baby, manhandled on stage like a life-sized puppet by Greg and Abigail Maupin, who play Punch and Judy. Judy is a shrew, Punch is a fool, and they fight a lot.
That's not very nice, Mr. Punch.
The process begins with a large piece of paper, soon covered in brainstormed gags. The jokes, like Punch throws the baby out the window, are refined into scenes in rehearsal.
Yeah, I should probably explain to the audience why this, say, I should probably explain why the situation was upsetting. Baby falls out the window one time. Shame on baby. Baby falls out the window several times. Eventually, wife starts to become more homicidal.
Punch and Judy's slapstick has roots in Italian commedia dell'arte. Greg calls commedia the sitcoms of 16th century Italy.
Semi-improvised pieces that were done by mask performers throughout Europe in that era, incredibly influential on like a lot of especially early Shakespeare comedies and Molière, all come out of that.
These masks cover more than half of the actor's face, so movements have to be large and precise. Abigail says working in mask is a whole body effort. It's technical, not emotional.
Well, and you can't be a method actor when you're doing this kind of thing. Feeling stuff does not help your performance.
Oh, no.
It actually makes it worse. The minute that you start getting into your character and crying or whatever, you lose your technical ability to use your body, to be presenting a picture.
The masks aren't just a nod to history. They make the violent characters seem less human, more like cartoons, or, as Greg says, like the puppets themselves.
And there was some, I think there was a question as to how we could translate this sort of whapping each other with sticks and throwing the baby out the window. That is a tradition of these puppet shows that little children laugh at in the UK. Can you do that with people? What does it turn into then?
The actors work hard in rehearsal to make sure audiences don't have to do homework before the show.
The nice thing about theater is that historical basis doesn't make much difference. What's happening in a room full of people on a given night is the only thing that really matters.
No Punchbacks isn't an academic exercise. It's 500-year-old jokes filtered through a Looney Tunes lens.
It puts the dung in Bill Dunk's Roma. No. No, it's not funny. It's not funny, but it's that kind of show.
Erin Keene, WFPL News.
And No Punchbacks will run through February 17th at the Bardstown. Erin Keene joins us live now. Hi, Erin. You know you have a special guest with you today.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having us. I'm here with Elena Passarello, author of Let Me Clear My Throat, which a collection of essays that's published by Sarah Band Books here in Louisville. Welcome, Elena.
Hi, thanks.
Tell us a little bit about the structure of this book. It's a collection of essays about the human voice.
Yep, that's pretty much it. It's 15 essays, each of them about an unforgettable moment in the history of the human voice. So there's essays on the Stella Scream, there's essays on ventriloquism, there's an essay on Judy Garland's 1961 concert at Carnegie Hall, essays on the castrati of 18th century opera. And then there are a few essays that sort of take a personal bent that have to do with my own life as a voiceover goon and an actor, which I was for about 10 years, and just as a person that has a voice that's grown and changed over the several decades that I've been on this planet.
It just changed a little bit while we were sitting.
Yeah.
would you read us a passage from one of the first chapters?
Sure. Here is the beginning of an essay about a film scream that has been, I think, to date in about 360 movies.
Wow.
Starting about 60 years ago. It's 61 years old this year. It's called The Wilhelm Scream. 1951, exterior, swamp, day. The camera rolls. A patsy stands waist deep in a soundstage mock-up of Florida alligator water. You know the type. Chicken eyes, hat askew, plywood gun. They never give guys like this a real gun. The water around him burbles. Something's got his right leg, and the patsy kicks that leg forward, throws back his hands, opens his mouth, and makes absolutely no noise. Most of us take our first gulp of air and immediately hurl it from our lungs in a scream. Perhaps this is a rejection of our initial breath. Maybe it's a celebration of hitting the outside world with both lungs running. But regardless, from birth, our vocal cords work like fingerprints, telling the unique tales of our specific bodies. The sounds they make bounce around inside us and convert tones into name tags. Hello, my larynx is this large. Hello, my sinuses are stuffed with mucus. Hello, my diaphragm is stretched tight. Listen to its shape as I spring air from it like a trampoline. Pleased to meet you. Like breaking a box of emergency glass to pull an alarm, when we make our voices scream, the beeline of Sirius Air not only buzzes the famous chords that create speech and song, it also crashes into a second pair of flaps at the top of the larynx, the false vocal cords. And this creates the grate that we hear in a screamer's tone, a grate that articulates the rarity of its use. It says that a scream is physical work we should only force on ourselves at moments of ultimatum. That's why we know to come running when we hear a scream. But storytelling complicates this physiological fact. Imagine a quiet Warner Brothers sound studio in the dead of night. A man whose name we'll never know watches the dailies of the film Distant Drums in a cloud of cigarette smoke, warming up his voice and thinking of alligators. He is a looper, a vocal pro hired to redo every unmic sound in the film, responses to punches, crowd gibber, barroom laughter, and he studies the mouths of extras like our condemned Patsy so he can make sounds that match their faces. On the screen before him, the Patsy dies silently in the swamp, his mouth widened almost to a grin, and the looper tries to mirror this strange gape, and he leans into the microphone. He inhales, closes his throat, and pushes out all the air that he has just pooled inside him. And up in the booth, an engineer corrals the session tape into a can, labeling it, "Man Gets Eaten by Alligator."
And we have "Man Gets Eaten by Alligator." Can we hear that?
We'll help! Yeah, I'll just fill my pipe.
It goes on and on and on. Now that you've heard it, if you hadn't heard the Wilhelm scream before, if you didn't know that's what you're hearing, you are going to start identifying it in at least 20 gruesome stormtrooper deaths in the entire Star Wars, you know, this series alone.
Yep. A lot of people in a lot of different franchises die making that sound. Stormtroopers, Nazis, both in Indiana Jones and in Inglourious Bastards. Somebody dies in Howard the Duck.
Howard the Duck. I saw that. Yeah, in the plane scene.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, so, you know, I wonder about this. When people are actually in moments of mortal distress, do they scream like that? Or is that merely a storytelling construct?
That's kind of one of the questions that I had when I wrote the essay was, one was, of course, why is this scream so famous? Because as we all just heard, it doesn't really sound very it's not exciting in the way that a true terror scream is. It's not like a Janet Leigh psycho scream that's sort of operatic and beautiful. It's not anguished like the Stella scream. It sounds really goofy. The only other famous scream that I think sounds like it is the Howard Dean yell, and I think they're actually quite similar. You should do a side-by-side comparison next time you have some open airspace. They sound really, really similar.
It's almost goofy. It is. Yeah. It's like banana peel, not like I'm getting eaten by alligators.
It's totally banana peel. That's a perfect description. And then I thought back in my own life to the times in which I've had to scream, which were very rare, and then the times where I've hurt someone in the sort of, you know, my baby's under a car and I need to use all the adrenaline to lift it up, these moments of extreme peril, the primal moments of screaming. And I don't remember ever hearing anything that sounds like that ever. It makes sense that we would jump into a higher register just because our voices are clenched and we have so much extra air. The placement is going to kind of go haywire. Like if you get surprised when you're playing a cello and your hand accidentally slides to the wrong place and hits a note. But for the most part, it's a lot more of a performance than an organic moment.
So how does the scream work in the instrument of our voices? How is the physiological apparatus there? How does that work?
Well, it's great because what the body does tells us, you know, we listen not just with our ears or with social constructs, we listen with our whole bodies, especially to the human voice, which resonates in many other places than just our mouths or our heads. People say that you can hear somebody with a broken foot in their voice. And so what we hear in the body when we hear a natural quote-unquote scream is this second pair of vocal cords that are never, ever used. They're not real vocal cords. They're these sort of evolutionary byproducts called the false vocal cords. And you've got so much air and adrenaline in your body that you just push all this extra air into your throat, and that grate that, like Janet Leigh, the great scream queens use, is actually the sound of those false vocal cords pushing together.
Wow.
It's the sound of your body hurting itself. It's the sound of your muscles ripping.
So another famous cinematic scream, Marlon Brando's anguished Stella in A Streetcar Named Desire. And every year there's a contest down in New Orleans during the Tennessee Williams conference where folks come together to compete for who can give the best Stella. And you won.
I did. I was the first female winner of the Stella Screaming Contest, but not the last, I have to say. I won in 2011, and this past year, a woman won. But she yelled for Stanley, so I'm still the only woman that's yelled Stella and won. I'm going to hold on to that till the day I die.
So real quick, before we wrap up, any words of advice for someone who's going to go compete in the Stella Screaming Contest?
If you're a Kentucky Screamer, I think you should bring some bourbon along, because the more it's not good for your vocal cords to drink liquor, but it's definitely good for your resolve.
Great. Right. Elena Passarello is reading tonight at the Inky Reading Series at the Bardstown. That's 7 p.m. That's downstairs while the Petamine is upstairs.
All right. Thanks, Aaron, and thanks, Elena. That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about today's topics, visit WFPL.org. Byline is produced by the WFPL News staff. I'm Rick Howlett. Have a great weekend.